nothing is truly original. Everything is about inspiration. And I think sometimes creativity in this sector can be taking inspiration from elsewhere and making that work in a sporting context or making that work with fans.
Hello and welcome to Outlines, a podcast about sport, stories and the media. My name's Owen Connolly. Hope you're well. It is great to have you listening. A real feature of sports media in this era is a kind of blurring of lines. Ideas and content are coming from all sorts of different places. Fans have varying expectations. Some are more agnostic about where they find things, others more discerning. Brands are more active in a wider range of media spaces, including those where they don't really have control of the story anymore. So what does that mean if you tell stories with a commercial imperative, sponsorship, marketing, that kind of thing? Our guest this time is very well placed to talk about such matters. Amar Singh is the Senior Vice President of Content and Creative at MKTG, advising all sorts of global brands on their activities in sport and entertainment. But he's also got a wider view on sports media. He spent many years working as a journalist at titles like The Evening Standard and The Sunday Times and was managing editor of Goal.com. He's been in-house at both a football club, West Ham, and a major consumer brand in Budweiser. And among other things, he's now created his own podcast and newsletter strand, The Sports Marketeer. We discussed how brands can best embrace storytelling and what makes for a great campaign, how communities of sports fans respond to commercial messaging and how to account for that, what creativity really means in this context, a couple of campaigns in focus from Messi delivering beers to sumo wrestlers on the loose in London, how the sports business talks about itself, and much more. As always, if you're enjoying the podcast, then anything you can do to get the word out is much appreciated. Rate, review, and subscribe. The social media details are in the show notes, so if you see something you like, then share it. And if you want to get involved, then get in touch. It'd be great to hear from you. This is a really enjoyable chat. I mean, they all are, but this one's good. Here is Amar Singh. You're pretty well set up for this kind of thing now, for podcasts and whatnot.
I've got the mic.
It's a familiar backdrop.
As you can tell, I don't have any technical issues whatsoever. We've just spent the last 10 minutes faffing around, haven't we? Restarting and not restarting. I'd quite like to get, you know, the arm that you get for the mic that goes across.
Yeah.
Quite like that. Yeah, I'm thinking about getting
it. Yeah, I used to have that and then I changed desk and the arm doesn't clamp because there's drawers. I mean, this is high-end technical.
Yeah,
discussion that I think
these are first world problems, you know.
Yeah,
just can't get the right tools and the right clamping action for my podcast mic.
And I know it's what the audience have tuned in for, but you know, I think we've got other stuff to cover as well. You're an interesting person to talk to in about these kind of ideas because you've kind of gone right across the space. I mean, it's increasingly common for kind of structural economic reasons in the industry that like people move from journalism to comms or into a kind of branded content space or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you've worked for a newspaper, you've worked for a football club, you've worked for an agency, and you work for an agency now, and prior to that you worked for a brand. Let's rather than kind of getting too nuanced or kind of too granular about it, what's the difference that you found in making the big jump from journalism into the sort of branded media space?
Yeah, I suppose I made that jump in a very subtle way, almost without realizing it. And I'll tell you why. It's because when I was working in journalism, I moved into, sports journalist, news journalist for a long time, then sports for a while. And then I became more of a news desk editor and a sports desk editor. So at Goal.com, it was more like a head of content role. And so I was managing teams globally, setting the content strategy globally. And then I went back to the Evening Standard because they needed someone with those skills. who understood the Evening Standard and their values and the culture of the newsroom and all of those things to come in and do that. So I did that for a couple of years, and then I went to Squawker for a couple of years and did that Squawker. So across those three roles, I'm managing sports desks, I'm managing journalists, I'm managing reporters. And after I left Squawker, I went to West Ham United, and West Ham United were looking for someone who could manage an editorial operation, who could manage a multi-platform content operation. So when you get a move like that, you're not thinking, well, I'm leaving journalism and I'm moving into marketing, or I'm moving into the branded world. You're thinking, well, I'm in sport right now. I'm managing a bunch of journalists who are writing football content. And I'm going to be doing that now, but under the umbrella of a club. So it wasn't a conscious transition, if you know what I mean. But it certainly was a moment where I was like, actually, I'm now no longer a journalist, strictly speaking. I'm actually now working on the agenda and at the behest of a club that has its own comms objectives and commercial objectives, and everything I need to do needs to support those.
Yeah. And I mean, it feels like it's a change that now has happened, right? It's if you go back to pre-2010, you might feel that there were more kind of walls between some of these operations and some of these ideas and what you might expect to find in each place. But I mean, we're talking on a podcast right now. One of the things that's really notable about podcasting as a business is this idea that you'll have something that is an entertainment or a kind of sports conversation product, but it's not like a branded, it's not directly servicing the needs of a brand, but it's probably funded at least indirectly by a brand who put up the money, who said, and I've seen this with a couple of kind of football podcasts recently, they're fronted by popular figures in the game. But the idea, you know, the model is not, we'll build an audience for this and then sell advertising against it. And the model is a brand has come in and backstopped the whole thing from the start, mm-hmm. but it's going out into the kind of the wilds, you know what I mean? It's not like it's still expected to kind of exist on its own terms and build an audience against stuff that's been more conventionally put together. I mean, would you say that's kind of, is that the biggest change in your time? Because where are we talking now when you started going into more of the sort of sponsorship area? We're talking about 7-8 years, I guess, for you now. Is that the biggest change, really, that sort of overlap
West Ham,
between those two worlds?
Yeah. West Ham was 2018, I believe. No, 2017 I moved to West Ham, and then I moved to AB InBev and worked for Budweiser in 2019. And then you're fully embedded in all things marketing and brand strategy and FMCG. I think in terms of your point about podcasts, I think the lines have been blurring for years. You know, I remember a time in newsrooms, in newspapers, advertising was on one floor, editorial and content was on the other floor, and you didn't really talk. And the two things were, it was church and state. The two things never came together. And then you might have a couple of people who are trying to do something called commercial content. And I always found that area very interesting, particularly when the writing was on the wall economically for the old model of journalism, if you like. And we're seeing redundancies every few months. We're seeing newspapers folding. I mean, this is the reality of the industry. So I think in any entity, you know, in any sense of perspective, there was always a need for advertising to prop up journalism. But there was always this sense when you're working in journalism that we are not going to be, you know, affected by advertisers. We are not going to be doing that. But of course, the reality is you are also following sometimes the agenda of your owners, even though it's not explicit, or the political leanings of the newspaper or the organization. So I don't think the two worlds were poles apart always, you know, 100% purely. It was just a perception, if you like. What's happened now is that the lines have completely blurred. The walls have come down between journalism and content, storytelling and brand and advertising. Advertising is storytelling now. People don't want to be advertised to. People will pay good money to have content and access to content, subscription content that does not serve them advertising. And that model has only increased. People don't want to be advertised to, and that is a privilege, if you like, particularly in the sort of Western world. So in that context, what do brands do? They can't advertise. They have to become storytellers. They have to create content. And I think branded content has become this extremely effective way of reaching people. Now, at the same time, what you've had is the proliferation of everything everywhere all at once on the internet, and everything finding its audience and the audience governing what they want to see. And that has led to some great things, and that has led to some pretty bad content as well. But you have to take the good with the bad. And you know, we can't be the judges of everything that's good or bad in the, on the internet. But with that, I think what has happened is people expect content, and people have become less discerning about where they get that content from. The amount of times people send me news from a meme account, and they think that that's news, you know, especially when it comes to football, you know, oh, hey, this account has just told me this, and I think this is true. And it's like, well, what's their sources? Are they employing journalists? People don't care anymore. You know, they just want the information that they can get. And whoever's providing the information in the best way, in a way that resonates with them, and in a way that entertains them or helps them justify their beliefs, is going to get shared and is going to drive that earned reach. And if that's a brand that's doing it, then the brand is doing well for itself.
Mm. It's interesting. These things kind of come around cyclically. It's amazing how we, because of that period of media, it's one, you know, lots of people who are working today didn't grow up with, frankly, because we're kind of talking about stuff that was starting to erode, you know, more than 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. But lots of these ideas have kind of come round. If you think about like soap opera, the origin of the term is that was sponsored by soap companies.
Exactly. Yeah.
Robert Redford did a part recently, made a film called Quiz Show about corruption in quiz shows in the 1950s in the States. Mm-hmm. And you used to have what you now have with podcasters doing their ad reads. You used to have the host of the show would kind of say, let me take a minute to tell you about Geritol. And he'd literally step in front of the podium and tell you about, you know, or Fred Flintstone advertising cigarettes, that kind of stuff. And it just kind of comes back around because the economic model serves it again. But I mean, sport is an interesting space for this kind of thing because it is an audience and particularly something like football. It was an audience and a culture, a community and a culture that existed before brands came along.
Yeah.
It's still kind of, even though none of this stuff is particularly new, there's still a little bit of friction, or historically there's been friction in getting anything beyond a sort of billboard message into those areas. So how much is your job about building trust and attention, and how much does that old thing of, you know, skepticism around commercialization still hold in the mid-2020s as we're now in?
Yeah, I think a big part of my role as head of content and creative at MKTG, 95% of the work that we do is with brands who are sponsoring rights holders in sport. And so our role is to help them achieve their objectives. And that can be through content, it can be through managing the partnership, it can be through hosting hospitality, it can be a range of things. In my world, though, it's often about setting the creative strategy, finding their role in that sport with that partnership, giving them permission to play, if you like, if they don't have that, if they're not a long established brand in terms of that sport, and then creating ideas, content ideas, and bringing it to life. And so my job ultimately is to deliver on the objectives that my client sets for me. What was the last part of your question, Owen?
I mean, it's more, it's the receptiveness, I guess. I mean, you've kind mm-hmm. of touched on it a little bit in mm-hmm. terms of how people just will find things, or how they'll, if they're getting entertained or getting the information, they don't particularly mind to the same yep. extent what the source is. But what, you know, does the old, the conventional wisdom about football fans being a little bit resistant to brand messaging, does that still hold, or is that, you know, is that a slightly outdated way of looking at it?
It's perhaps an oversimplification. What we look at is a measure called receptivity. So traditionally, a lot of people say, oh, we want to go to sport, we want to work in sport because of passion. Fans are really passionate, but passion is a difficult thing to measure. It's not the most helpful metric, I think. How do you measure mm-hmm. passion? What we look at is receptivity, and that is how receptive a fan base is in a particular place around a particular sport to a sponsor entering that sport. Now, if you look at really mature sponsorship markets like Europe and the USA to an extent, receptivity tends to be lower. It's the lowest in places like the UK around football. Mm. As you say, your hypothesis was that, Owen, which is UK football fans are not really in it for the sponsors. Okay. But that is changing, and younger fans are growing up in a world where they're more used to sponsors and more used to commercial messaging and more used to engaging with brands. And they're just a little less precious about football compared to boomers, for example, who follow football. On the flip side, if you go to India, for example, and you look at the Indian cricket fan, the Indian IPL fan, they're highly receptive. They're completely opposite. They are ready to engage with every sponsor that wants to invest in their sport. They are ready and open and willing to engage with sponsors if those sponsors are enhancing their experience of the sport. So different markets, it's really important to have the data, to have the understanding of fans. And we put them into three buckets: receptive, selective. Selective are a bit more discerning. They really want to know how a sponsor is going to make their sport better and make their experience of fandom better, and they're a bit harder to win over. And non-receptive. So non-receptive, for example, might be, you know, a 60, 65-year-old guy who goes to St. James's Park every weekend and has done that for the last 40 years, and he's not really interested in engaging with whichever brand is activating. I mean, he's in it for a completely different reason. And you're not necessarily going to win those over through sponsorship. So don't bother. So those are ways that help you kind of understand how to speak to fans and what works with certain types of fans.
Mm. And then how do you address that? If you have a brand approach you, MTKG, and you say, have I got that the right way around, by the way?
MKTG. You've got the T and the K the other way around.
I just heard myself saying it. I was like, hang on, that doesn't make any sense. MKTG, do you advise them, well, you're going to be dealing with a category of fans who are in this bucket, so the storytelling and the campaign that we build around your brand is going to be like water, basically going to find the way through, and that's going to limit the stuff we can do, but it's going to mean that ultimately it's more effective? Or do you start by saying, can we lay some groundwork? Can we turn more of the people from each category? Can we get them more people into that receptiveness category first? Or, you know, I guess by the time a brand's come to you, right? Like there's only so much they can do, and it's going to be a quicker hit than lots of their marketing activities. But like, how do you approach that side of it?
It really depends. Sometimes a brand will come to us and say, we want to work in football. Who should we work with in football? And then we'll look at their audience and say, actually, you've got a better fit if you work in Formula One. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, they'll make assumptions. Or they'll say, hey, we want to work in paddle. You know, where do we even begin in working with paddle? And we take them through the ecosystem. It really all depends on their objectives. Sometimes a brand will come to us and say, oh, the CMO has just signed a deal with this sport because he's friends with the person who runs the sport and he wants to do something with his mate, and we have no idea what to do. Can you help navigate us through this? I mean, that's happened before, and that happens in the industry all the time. So our role is to really navigate those brands through those challenges. And there can be so many different stages of that cycle, as I say. The key is activate with the receptives effectively, turn as many of those selectives into non-receptives, into receptives, and don't worry about the receptives, right? You don't turn the selectives into non-receptives. Yeah. And don't worry about the non-receptives, but it all begins with data. If you've got the insight into fans, and that's something we invest a lot in at MKTG, we pride ourselves on really understanding fandom, where it lives. It's always moving. It's never still. It's something that we have to continue invest in terms of research. It's something I find fascinating as part of my role as well, understanding cultural trends and human behavior and how we change how we engage with our passions. It's changing all the time. It's a very interesting area. And our job is to take that information and make it useful for our clients.
Mm. So that takes us into, you know, a part of your title and a part of your role is creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that mean in this sector? You know, advertising and marketing, there are awards for creativity. There are awards for you know, and lots of kudos for doing a campaign that people like and kind of want to enjoy on its face. But is it really about the quality of the idea, or is it really about the effectiveness of the execution?
Yeah, I think very few people really understand what creativity is or means. And I don't think a single definition can help, because I think sometimes creativity can be about finding a creative solution to something as much as it is about creating something visual or doing something that's more traditionally associated with concepts of creativity.
Mm.
You know, so John Hegarty, who's like a legend in advertising land, and he's the guy behind the great Levi's adverts of the 80s and 90s and Audi's rebrand. He's a big evangelist of creativity, and I read a lot of his stuff. And he said, originality depends on the obscurity of your sources, which I thought is hilarious, because nothing is truly original. Everything is about inspiration. And I think sometimes creativity in this sector can be taking inspiration from elsewhere and making that work in a sporting context, or making that work with fans. What I look for is originality, absolutely, when you can find that in terms of in its context. Cultural impact is really important. Different disciplines are used when you're bringing a campaign to life. Using talent in a unusual, unexpected way can be really creative as well. And using multiple touch points can be really creative as well. So I think creativity is probably the single most important thing in this industry, the single most important differentiator in this industry between what is a good agency and what is a great agency. And I think what we've tried to do over the last few years at MKTG is put the processes in to enable more creativity and bring in more diversity of perspective and bring in more creative thinking and encourage creativity, because everyone is creative. But only a few people have the privilege of being able to do that for a living.
Mm. What does that look like on its feet, those changes to the process that you're talking about?
I think it's hiring people that don't think like everyone else in sport. I think it's a great sector. I've met some amazing people in this sector, but there is an archetype in this industry a little bit. And it's very easy to hire within that archetype sometimes, you know? Just like any industry, particularly the highly desired ones, and the media is no different. People hire friends, and people hire people that look like people, and people that look like them and act like them and come from similar backgrounds.
What could you possibly be talking about, Emma?
Exactly. But it happens. And so being intentional about bringing in perspectives from other industries, bringing in diversity of perspective, bringing in diversity of background is a step on the path of creativity. 100%. Enabling the processes to let creativity thrive. So what does a creative person need, or does a creative team need in order to respond to a brief? Briefing a creative team properly. Investing in strategy, because you can't have good creative without the strategic foundations. And you can't have good strategy without great data and insights. So it's like a house, you know, you have to build it up. And you have to be super intentional about every bit of that process. I'm quite evangelical about that process. People will tell you at MKTG, I'm always banging the drum to follow a certain process, but it's because, and I've learned it from people smarter than me and more experienced than me in this industry. And they were evangelical about it when they were teaching me about it as well. And so I truly believe that you need to have a really, really strong process to set up success in terms of creativity.
Mm. I mean, it's a funny thing, because again, coming back to the comparison between the branded space and other parts of sports media, you've got more tools to play with in some respects, even though you're working within the parameters of being brand safe and having a sales or awareness message kind of baked into it. I'm thinking of something you did. This may have been when you were at Budweiser,
mm-hmm.
but when Leo Messi passed the scoring record and you sent beers to all the goalkeepers who he'd scored past. I think Manuel Almunia had a very good night. But there's just things you can do that go beyond here is a piece of media that you present for consumption that get people talking, or that, you know, kind of draw in parts of experiences or performance or you know, stunt culture or whatever. Like, how do you draw those things together into a campaign, and how do you sell that in as well? That this is another way we could do this. We don't just have to, we don't just have to think about where the brand's going to appear, but we can think about where it comes into a ritual or a story or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I'll say Budweiser. I spent 3 years working at Budweiser, and I think when we're talking about brands and storytelling in sport, Budweiser are right up there. And that's not just in terms of football, but in terms of everything they've done around the NFL and NBA, stuff they've done with Dwayne Wade, for example, like just incredible legacy of storytelling and sport. It's unbelievable, and you can't help but being inspired in that environment and working with such amazing marketers. Messi 644 I was very fortunate to work on that. It was the moment we first discussed that idea, we all knew we were on to a winner, because I think it was Copper 90 who we were working with at the time as one of our agency partners, brought the idea to the table with a few other ideas, and we were like, this is brilliant. If we can pull this off, this is going to bang on social, as the kids say. Do the kids still say that? I don't know. I'll roll with it. But we had the challenge, which was, how do we get Messi on board with this? Because he's not going to troll every goalkeeper he's faced. But the great thing was, is when we took him and his people through it, he really liked it and he was on board with it. And then we knew, and La Liga, who we were partnering with, were also on board with it, and they were supporting us with it. And the way we got it done was in a really respectful way, and Messi writing this handwritten note to all the goalkeepers saying, in order for me to achieve this record, I had to get the ball past you. So that was unbelievable kind of humility and just very, very Lionel Messi. But it took months of planning. And at one point, it looked like he was actually going to leave before he broke the record and move to Manchester City that summer. But fortunately, that didn't happen. But we had, you know, getting the addresses of all the goalkeepers, doing all the research, producing the bottles. And it just worked on so many levels. And, you know, one reason why it worked was we had everyone talking about it on social media. Absolutely. Some people looked at it as a really cheeky thing and they were sharing it. This is hilarious. Another reason why it worked and was so creative was it got the goalkeepers sharing it.
Mm-hmm.
Goalkeepers that we didn't have to sign a contract with, they all wanted to be part of that. To get footballers to do something and not pay them is creativity in itself, I think, you know. And another reason was it had the product at the center of it, because you had these bottles and you had people posting the bottles and you had people posting the product. So there were so many reasons, and it was shining a light on Messi and his greatness and bringing to life his partnership, the partnership and all the values that we wanted to bring. So it just ticked so many boxes creatively. And like I say, I was one of several people, a big team who worked on that. And it was a career highlight and it won lots of accolades, and, you know, it was highly memorable. But I think the impact of campaigns are, do they deliver ROI? And that absolutely smashed it in terms of ROI, because you're driving earned reach. Everyone is writing about it. Everyone is talking about it. Yes, you've had to invest heavily on a partnership with the best footballer on the planet, but ultimately you're getting so much more because everyone is talking about it. You're capturing the football zeitgeist for a week, which is what we did.
Mm. I mean, you know, you've touched on a few things there that make for a really great campaign and make for a campaign that kind of feeds into different aspects of the story. This, you know, when those goalkeepers tell the story of their careers, the fact that they played Lionel Messi will be a part of that, and it would be the same whether it was another great player or another, you know, being a part of someone else's story is a story of your own sometimes. But all the sort of brand metrics are in there and everything else. Is there a process that you go through to build a campaign? Where do you start from? How do you make sure you're weaving all those different things in? Or do you just sort of, you know, is it such a collaborative thing and there are so many other parameters you got to think of that you take it a different way each time?
Well, what I like to look at is you always try and, well, you start with the fan. That's really important. Who's the target audience? Who are we trying to reach? How are we going to reach them? Where do they live online? Where do they live in real life? Where do they buy products? So, you know, understanding the objectives and understanding who the target audience. super, super important. Then you go into your strategy, you work on almost the game plan in terms of how you're bringing it to life, what you're doing, how you're going to reach them, what the positioning is, what the platform is that makes sense, how you, in the case of sponsorship, you're trying to find the connective tissue between a footballer in this case and a brand. So what's the connective tissue between Budweiser and Lionel Messi? It's, you know, it with these values around kind of freedom and pursuing your ambition and all these kind of American values, I'd say, you know, is how it kind of began with Budweiser. But the positioning that we were focusing on for Budweiser at the time was this platform called Beer King, which was all about chasing your ambition, living your life, living the life you wanted to live. And so how do we then articulate that with footballers? So with Sergio Ramos, for example, we did a campaign based on his tattoos and we created tattoo bottles, and his tattoos kind of told his life story. So it was storytelling around Sergio Ramos's journey. And then with Messi, as you know, we took it to another level and we did that huge moment with Messi 644. So I think once you've kind of got your target audience and you've got your strategic kind of foundation, that's when you go to creative, and that's where you start inviting ideas and you start canvassing for ideas and you start chewing over different concepts. And that's where we landed with that one. So that's it. And then when you're talking about sponsorship, it's really, really important to understand what is it that we have access to as part of this sponsorship, this partnership. Our clients are looking for value. They're not looking for an agency to say, hey, here's another 5 million to spend on talent, you know, unless that's the brief, in which case, amazing. But they're looking for us to say, look, this is what you get as part of your partnership, and here's how we're going to absolutely maximize these assets for you, absolutely make the most out of what you're getting so you get maximum value. And then the rights holder likes that as well. You know, we had a great relationship with the Premier League and La Liga when we were at Budweiser because we were leveraging their assets in a really imaginative way. And they were taking that to other sponsors and saying, you should do more of this, you should do more of that. Look at what Budweiser are doing.
Yeah. What's a campaign that you've really enjoyed recently?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if this counts as a campaign, but I love the simplicity of it. The sumo wrestlers in London over the last 2 weeks has been amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, there was it came across such a simple stunt, if you like, but obviously there was a lot of planning that went into it. But the simple idea of taking these incredible, distinctive-looking athletes and showing them around London, photographing them around certain landmarks, working with photographers, and just releasing all these images into the media, it absolutely, you know, went crazy on social media, didn't it? And so I just loved the simplicity of it, but just the impact of it was great.
The Kiko Man soy sauce bottle, did you see that?
That was brilliant. Yeah, I loved all the presents. It just feels like we need this kind of wholesome content at the moment because the world is such a crazy place. And I think a sumo wrestler getting a giant soy sauce bottle is just the sort of thing that just makes us all feel a little bit better about the world, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, those kind of really expansive activities, you know, I'm sure they're tons of fun to work on, and it's people talk about them and really enjoy them on their own terms or just, you know, all together in the round. They have fun looking at that kind of stuff. When you are dealing with a brand who maybe are not as comfortable a fit, or you know, it's shallower, the association, or they might not have the same resources, the same assets that they can use. You know, how do you approach that? Where it might be much more conventional, much more simple. How do you approach that to a point where people are satisfied at the end and they think, right, that's done what it needed to do? I mean, because that's another form of creativity, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the sort of creativity that accountants really like, isn't it? You know, working on a tight budget and delivering some impact. But yes, I mean, we work with big global brands. I've worked with, you know, massive global brands with big, big budgets. And that's great. That was the first thing that really hit me, by the way, when I had made that move from journalism into marketing, was I'm in a place where people will really invest in creativity. People will really put a lot of money in creativity. I think in journalism, as you know, there's always that tightening, you know, that squeezing of budgets. But in terms of smaller rights holders, smaller brands, of course, it's about establishing the objectives, managing the expectations. What can you do? Sometimes, you know, a great plan, a great strategic plan, some great tactical executions can go a long way. You know, the Grand Sumo tournament might have had a big budget, I'm not sure, but that was a really impactful campaign that probably didn't cost a massive amount in terms of taking your talent around London and taking photographs in outside iconic landmarks. Simple, effective, mass awareness. So I think it's about understanding what the objectives are. I always say, understand the objectives, get to the bottom of them, and be realistic in terms of what you can achieve with the budget you have.
Okay. You have your own sort of media brand. I guess it is a media brand because it's the Sports Marketeer newsletter and podcast series. What inspired you to do that? Was it just an out and out side project? Was it the old journalistic itch that needed scratching? How did you come to start that?
Yeah, a little bit of both. Owen, I think being a journalist, wanting to tell stories, wanting to write, has never really leaves you. I'm yet to meet a journalist or a former journalist who says, I just don't really want to tell stories anymore. So yeah, my feeling is it never leaves you. I have opinions all the time. I like comment pieces. I like writing opinion. I sort of started it as a, let me break down campaigns that I like and talk about them and explain why I think they're impactful, or it almost kind of demystify sports marketing a little bit. And that was good. And it got me some traction and I thought, this is good. And then I thought, well, again, journalistic instincts, let me not just make this about me and me talking about my views. Let me also speak to people. I've got good connections. I've got an industry. I've got a black book. So I started interviewing people and getting quotes for my newsletter. And then as I started interviewing people, I started recording interviews with people. And then I recorded an interview with this amazing expert called Dr. Marcus Collins, who's like an expert in culture and sports marketing from the US. And I listened to this interview back and I was like, I should just make this a podcast. And so I edited it and I put it out as a podcast. It was such a good conversation. I put it out as a podcast and I got an amazing response. And I already knew, you know, just as you know, people like listening to podcasts and there is an audience, however niche, you know, there is an audience for podcasts and it will find its audience. And so the newsletter has taken a bit of a backseat. The podcast has become a bit more important because it gets so much traction in terms of my audience. And I've just grown a community of people in the industry. I've got people who follow, who subscribe to the newsletter, who work in big brands, who work in the Premier League, in La Liga, in NBA teams, in NFL teams. So I think it's definitely resonating with them. And I've always had a sense that sports marketing in particular is a little bit underserved. Mm-hmm. It's not something where there's a load of platforms out there talking about it. There are some really good ones, absolutely. So where I go with it, I haven't quite decided yet. I quite enjoy recording podcasts, writing newsletters when I feel like I've got something unique, a unique take to add on something or something really. I don't want to go down the route of every week I have to write something.
Yeah.
I'd quite like to just post something for my audience when I feel like I've got something quite significant to say or something, an interesting take on something.
Yeah. Kind of keeps you in the conversation. Like is there anything surprising that you've learned from the process? I mean, not on the sort of technical side, because you know these things are a pain in the neck, but from having stuff go out there, and whether it's how it comes back into your day job or whether it's the connections that you've made or maintained as a result of doing it.
Yeah, I think it might be because of my background, my experience, but I do look at things through a cultural lens quite a lot. I'm quite mm-hmm. passionate about that. I'm not afraid to shy away from talking about areas such as diversity and equality. These are things that are really passionate for me. And I've always said that wherever I work, wherever I am, I will try and be a positive force in that respect and put my views and my experience into that. And I've had a really good response when I have gone down that road. And I think I'm inside sport in a way. We're working with brands, we're working with rights holders all the time. And the easiest thing to do is to not say when things can be better. And, you know, I am really passionate about these things. And increasingly, I think my output on Sports Marketeer has leaned more towards wider cultural issues, wider societal issues, and looking at sport through that lens. I'm still really passionate about writing about marketing and brand strategy, and I do that too. But that's where my head is at the moment. And I think I'm going to write about, it's my platform, I'm going to write about what I'm really passionate and interested about. And I've been pleasantly surprised that I've had such a positive response.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's some very good sports trade platforms, some excellent sports trade platforms, let's be fair. And the UK is a real center of them. And, you know, speaking from personal experience in that regard, but like, how effective or how good do you think the sports industry is at talking about itself, whether it's confronting those issues or whether it's understanding what it really is, you know, whether it's sort of borrowing on and reframing ideas effectively? How good do you think it is at managing those conversations?
Good question. I think the sports industry is very good at looking at certain topics, such as TV rights, for example. Some really good content out there on TV rights and streaming. And I think, and rightly so, understandably so, because that is what is guiding the future of the industry. Where I think the sports industry is lacking at times is understanding fandom, understanding culture, looking more outward. There's so much money in sport now in the UK, and you get a sense of that when you go to Leaders and you go to Sports Pro and you go to these events. People follow the money, and the commercial side of the conversation understandably gets a lot of focus. The cultural side, fan trends, the human side of sport is something that shouldn't be overlooked. And I think that is an area where we need to amplify more voices.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I have a working theory on that. That's all that's like sport as an industry, as a business, particularly in the UK and Western Europe, it was a huge cultural community phenomenon for decades and decades and decades. And then the business came along and worked out, we can make money through all this. And it's now reaching a point where the business has to evolve, but it had kind of left. It was almost like the culture was able to get on its own terms, and then the media was able to get on its own terms, and one got outsourced to the other kind of thing. And now it kind of has to look a little more inwardly and has to understand some of those deeper roots a little bit more in order to regenerate the business side of things. And, you know, it's at a disadvantage compared to other industries. Music and entertainment were always creative from the very start, and you had to spin up the product in order to make the business happen. Sport never, that was never quite the way it was. It has amateur roots. You know, it's a working theory. It's not a very tightly worded one, but you kind of get what I mean.
Oh, no, I'm totally with you, and I totally get it, and I completely agree. I mean, it's sport is having to become more like sports entities are having to think more like brands. They are competing against each other for our attention. They are competing against other passion points. They're competing against gaming and, you know, people going online and other passions. You know, the attention economy has completely changed everything for sport. And that old route of, you know, my dad supported this team, so I'm going to support this team, and my son's going to support this. I mean, it's completely changed. It's completely broken, that model. So as more money has grown into the industry, particularly if you look at football, for example, people have to remove the thinking around we are more precious than a transactional relationship. Yes, football clubs mean a lot more to us than products do, absolutely. But at the same time, these football clubs and football organizations have to think more like brands. And we don't see it so much over here because the Premier League is huge. But if you look outside the Premier League, these entities are trying everything to win our attentions. Yeah. Bundesliga are working with, That's Football and Mark Goldbridge to get younger audiences and younger eyeballs on Bundesliga football. La Liga are looking at having games in Miami, and that was scuppered last week by the players. So there's this tension between the old traditions of sports and almost what we love about them traditionally to this existential threat that they need to move into this new commercial world. And that tension, and we saw that come to boil with the Super League debacle as well. And that is going to be a feature of sport like football for the next 10, 15 years.
Yeah, and there's a risk that if you get it wrong, and you know the Super League's a good example, but there's this kind of recent history of sports trying to 2020-ify and missing what made 2020 work was that it kind of had roots and a connection and was an effective replication of the game that already existed, yeah. but was something different at the same time that served like a commercial and a lifestyle need, but. You can just look at other things and say, oh, we need to make sport do that. And then you can get it wrong. You can kind of be looking at the wrong end of the equation and change something that's kind of difficult to change back.
Yeah. I mean, I posted a piece of content by Saracens the other day where they've kind of rebranded and it's very football-y and they're talking about North London and it almost looks like an Arsenal ad to me. And on the one hand, I'm like, well, is this really rugby? Doesn't feel like it. But on the other hand, I'm like, well, fair play. You're trying something new.
Yeah.
You're trying to go after a more diverse audience. But it felt to me a little bit like, great piece of content, very creative, but it felt to me like this is how Premiership rugby wants to see itself rather than the reality of what it is right now.
Yeah, I am keeping you from a call with your boss, which I am very conscious of. But we've got a few questions left that we ask to every guest. And before we do, and this is actually this, you know, little section of the conversation is quite a neat one into a question I want to try on you that I might add for other people as we go. Mm-hmm. Is there a non-sports piece of storytelling or media trend that's made you think differently about sport?
Interesting one. I think something that's really made me think about sport and the industry and how we work is my wife is a health and beauty journalist. She's worked in that sector for a very long time. And we've just come out of the Diwali season. And what the health and beauty brands do around this time is they'll have events around Diwali and they'll engage with the Asian community, for example, through that. Now, whether that is demonstrative of a year-long commitment to diverse communities or not is debatable. However, for me, it's a sign that they have a strategy where they understand that engaging with South Asian consumers is incredibly important. I think that's happened sooner for industries such as beauty and cosmetics because of skin tones and because they've realized that they need to cater to this audience. And obviously sport is very different. However, I think sport is struggling to really understand the value of engaging with diverse audiences. And that made me think about, you know, why this industry, cosmetics, beauty, health, is so far ahead when it comes to that. And so I think that made me reflect on that a little bit, Owen, because yeah, we do things around Black History Month, South Asian Heritage Month, but it's been quite a tumultuous year in terms of the political climate, mm-hmm. in terms of how ethnic minorities in this country feel. And I do think, you know, this is the time for organizations that really understand that they have a diverse fan base or understand that the diverse communities and consumers from ethnic minorities and fans from ethnic minorities mean something to them. I see too much paralysis in the industry, not enough proactivity. And I think, first and foremost, it's a business opportunity that is being missed.
Okay. I like that answer. I think that's That's a promising question. We'll have to think about whether that works again. But here are the three we have been asking everybody so far. Do you have an origin story or something that sparked your interest in sport?
I do. It deepened my love of football and my curiosity for journalism. And it's the 1986 Panini Mexico 86 sticker album. I mean, I love that sticker album. I remember taking it to school, swapping stickers with my mates. I remember in the middle of it, there was almost like a funny section, like cartoon style section. And I remember there being players, but there was also a journalist on the side of the pitch. And I really wanted that sticker for a long time, you know, and I remember getting that sticker and thinking one day I want to be that journalist. So that was 1986. And so I had an encyclopedic knowledge of Mexico 86 when I was a kid and which players were there and all of those things. But I also really wanted to go and cover a World Cup as well, which was an ambition. And so in 2010, I was able to cover the World Cup in South Africa and spent a month out there, and it was incredible. So I was able to fulfill my ambition, but it all began with that sticker album.
Love it. What's your favorite piece of sports storytelling?
Gosh, I have so many. I do love sports storytelling. I love sports documentaries, like ESPN 30 for 30 series is incredible. Documentaries like The Two Escobars or No Mas, which is amazing. The Last Dance was incredible, obviously, during the pandemic that had us all gripped, didn't it? I think Asif Kapadia is the king of biographical documentaries. Senna, Diego Maradona. Now he's done Kenny Dalglish as well. I can't wait to watch that. So I love all of that. I'll also give a shout to an incredible podcast, which for some reason I think has stopped, but I devoured it, which was Heroes and Humans of Football. I don't know if you listened to that, but it was Simon Cooper and Mirin Khan.
Yeah, I didn't listen to that, which might maybe gives an indication into why it stopped. But
it's your fault, I mean, for not listening to it.
My fault specifically, no, but you know, we're talking archetypes here, aren't we?
Go back and listen to it and you will hear the most incredible storytelling around some of the biggest protagonists in football, you know, from Cruyff to Maradona. They even did an incredible episode on Erik ten Hag, which made me interested in Erik ten Hag. So that's how good it was.
Yeah, I will check that out. Asif Kapadia, I mean, the Senna and speaking of 30 for 30, is it, I think 17-6-94 is the one.
Yes.
About the day of the O.J. Simpson car chase and the Jack Nicklaus's last round of golf and round at the US Open and opening and the World Cup all happening on the same day.
Yes.
And it's intercutting without any talking heads. And Senna does something similar, era does something similar. Both films that made you think like there's a different one. Now that we're moving into this era of kind of massive library footage, there's just different ways of telling some of these stories.
Yeah, I just love it when a storyteller can zoom out, look at the person, absolutely, and the athlete, but also look at the political context of that person. And I think Asif Kapadia did that incredibly with Senna. He really captured what he meant to Brazil and with Maradona as well, in terms of not just what he meant to Argentina, but what he also meant to the people of Napoli as well and all the cultural elements of that. And as I said, I mean, Kenny Dalglish is my childhood hero, so I can't wait to watch that one.
Cool. What's a sports story you'd like to tell or see someone else tell?
Oh, gosh, there's loads. I think we probably need a definitive piece on Lewis Hamilton.
Okay.
I think he's coming close to retirement and he's probably one of the most significant athletes of our lifetime in terms of what he's done in Formula One and where he's come from. On a personal level, I would love to see, I'm a Liverpool fan, and I think a documentary around the rivalry between Liverpool and Chelsea, Benitez versus Mourinho, feels like an undertold story and one that was just so intense and so toxic for about 5-6 years.
Yeah,
those matches were just so intense.
Where was it, the 2005 and 2007? And possibly again, like two or three semi-finals that were just so ridiculously close and so spiteful and like Yeah.
You hated those games. They were unbelievable. You couldn't watch away. You couldn't look away, but you hated being on the losing side of those games. And there was so much to it. Rivalry between Gerrard and Lampard, rivalry between Benitez and Mourinho, contrasting characters, the new money of Chelsea, the oldest institution of Liverpool. Like, it was a fascinating moment in time in terms of football. And I think I'd love to see a definitive documentary on that rivalry.
Okay. Well, we'll keep an eye out for any and all of that. But Amar, it's been a lot of fun.
Thank you, Owen. It's been a pleasure.
Outlines is an original production from 2640.